Chapter 11. Phew! The time was barely 10 o'clock at night, but chilly gusts of wind with a taste of rain in them had well-nigh depeopled the streets. Trying doors as he went, twirling his club with many intricate and artful movements, turning now and then, to cast his watchful eye down the Pacific thoroughfare, the officer, with his stalwart form and slight swagger, made a fine picture of a guardian of the peace. The vicinity was one that kept early hours. Now and then you might see the lights of a cigar store, or of an all-night lunch counter, but the majority of the doors belonged to business places that had long since been closed. When about midway of a certain block the policeman suddenly slowed his walk. In the doorway of a darkened hardware store a man leaned, with an unlighted cigar in his mouth. As the policeman walked up to him the man spoke up quickly. "It's all right, officer," he said, reassuringly. "I'm just waiting for a friend. It's an appointment made 20 years ago. Sounds a little funny to you, doesn't it? Well, I'll explain if you'd like to make certain it's all straight. About that long ago there used to be a restaurant, where this store stands, Big Joe Brady's restaurant. Until 5 years ago," said the policeman. "Tea was torn down then." The man in the doorway struck a match, and lit a cigar. The light showed a pale, square-jawed face with keen eyes, and a little white scar near his right eyebrow. His scarf pin was a large diamond, oddly set. 20 years ago tonight," said the man, "I dined here at Big Joe Brady's with Jimmy Wells, my best chum, and the finest chap in the world. He and I were raised here in New York, just like two brothers, together. I was 18, and Jimmy was 20. The next morning I was to start for the West to make my fortune. You couldn't have dragged Jimmy out of New York. He thought it was the only place on earth. Well, we agreed that night that we would meet here again exactly 20 years from that date and time, no matter what our conditions might be, or from what distance we might have to come. We figured that in 20 years each of us ought to have our destiny worked out and our fortunes made, whatever they were going to be." "It sounds pretty interesting," said the policeman. "Ather a long time between meets, though, it seems to me. Haven't you heard from your friend since you left?" "Well, yes, for a time we corresponded," said the other. "But after a year or two we lost track of each other. You see, the West is a pretty big proposition, and I kept hustling around over it pretty lively. But I know Jimmy will meet me here if he's alive, for he always was the truest, stanchest old chap in the world. He'll never forget. I came 1,000 miles to stand in this door tonight, and it's worth it if my old partner turns up." The waiting man pulled out a handsome watch, the lids of it set with small diamonds. 9:55, he announced. "Tea was exactly 10 o'clock when we parted here at the restaurant door. Did pretty well out west, didn't you?" asked the policeman. "You bet. I hope Jimmy has done half as well. He was a kind of plodder though, good fellow as he was. I've had to compete with some of the sharpest wits going to get my pile. A man gets in a groove in New York. It takes the West to put a razor edge on him." The policeman twirled his club, and took a step or two. "I'll be on my way. Hope your friend comes around all right. Going to call time on him sharp?" "I should say not," said the other. "I'll give him half an hour at least. If Jimmy is alive on earth he'll be here by that time. So long, officer." "Good night, sir," said the policeman, passing on along his beat, trying doors as he went. There was now a fine, cold drizzle falling, and the wind had risen from its uncertain puffs into a steady blow. The few foot passengers astir in that quarter hurried dismally and silently along with coat collars turned high and pocketed hands. And in the door of the hardware store the man who had come 1,000 miles to fill an appointment, uncertain almost to absurdity, with the friend of his youth, smoked his cigar and waited. About 20 minutes he waited, and then a tall man in a long overcoat, with collar turned up to his ears, hurried across from the opposite side of the street. He went directly to the waiting man. Is that you, Bob? He asked, doubtfully. Is that you, Jimmy Wells? Cried the man in the door. Bless my heart! Exclaimed the new arrival, grasping both the other's hands with his own. Tease Bob, sure as fate. I was certain I'd find you here, if you were still in existence. Well, well, well. 20 years is a long time. The old gone, Bob. I wish it had lasted, so we could have had another dinner there. How has the West treated you, old man? Bully, it has given me everything I asked it for. You've changed lots, Jimmy. I never thought you were so tall by 2 or 3 inches. Oh, I grew a bit after I was 20. Doing well in New York, Jimmy? Moderately. I have a position in one of the city departments. Come on, Bob. We'll go around to a place I know of, and have a good long talk about old times. The two men started up the street, arm in arm. The man from the West, his egotism enlarged by success, was beginning to outline the history of his career. The other, submerged in his overcoat, listened with interest. At the corner, stood a drugstore, brilliant with electric lights. When they came into this glare, each of them turned simultaneously, to gaze upon the other's face. The man from the West stopped suddenly, and released his arm. You're not Jimmy Wells, he snapped. 20 years is a long time, but not long enough, to change a man's nose from a Roman to a pug. It sometimes changes a good man into a bad one, said the tall man. You've been under arrest for 10 minutes, Silky Bob. Chicago thinks you may have dropped over our way, and wires us, she wants to have a chat with you. Going quietly, are you? That's sensible. Now, before we go on to the station, here's a note I was asked to hand you. You may read it here at the window. It's from Patrolman Wells. The man from the West unfolded the little piece of paper handed him. His hand was steady when he began to read, but it trembled a little by the time he had finished. The note was rather short. Tilda Bob. I was at the appointed place on time. When you struck the match to light your cigar, I saw it was the face of the man wanted in Chicago. Somehow I couldn't do it myself, so I went around and got a plainclothes man to do the job. Jimmy. Tilda. Lost on dress parade, Mr. Towers Chandler was pressing his evening suit in his hall bedroom. One iron was heating on a small gas stove, the other was being pushed vigorously back and forth, to make the desirable crease that would be seen later on extending in straight lines from Mr. Chandler's patent leather shoes to the edge of his low-cut vest. So much of the hero's toilet may be interested to our confidence. The remainder may be guessed by those whom genteel poverty has driven to ignoble expedient. Our next view of him shall be as he descends the steps of his lodging house immaculately and correctly clothed, calm, assured, handsome in appearance, the typical New York young clubman setting out, slightly bored, to inaugurate the pleasures of the evening. Chandler's honorarium was $18 per week. He was employed in the office of an architect. He was 22 years old. He considered architecture to be truly an art, and he honestly believed, though he would not have dared to admit it in New York, that the Flatiron Building was inferior to design to the great cathedral in Milan. Out of each week's earnings, Chandler set aside $1. At the end of each 10 weeks, with the extra capital thus accumulated, he purchased one gentleman's evening from the bargain counter of stingy old Father Time. He arrayed himself in the regalia of millionaires and presidents. He took himself to the quarter, where life is brightest and showiest, and there dined with taste and luxury. With $10 a man may, for a few hours, play the wealthy idler to perfection. The sum is ample for a well-considered meal, a bottle bearing a respectable label, commensurate tips, a smoke, cab fare and the ordinary etc.s. This one delectable evening culled from each dull 70 was to Chandler a source of renascent bliss. To the society bud comes but one debut, it stands alone sweet in her memory when her hair is whitened. But to Chandler each 10 weeks brought a joy as keen, as thrilling, as new as the first had been. to cinnamon tilde bond vivants tilde under palms, in the swirl of concealed music, to look upon the tilde habitues tilde of such a paradise, and to be looked upon by them, what is a girl's first dance and short-sleeved toe compared with this? A Broadway Chandler moved with the Vesperton dress parade. For this evening he was an exhibit as well as a gazer. For the next 69 evenings he would be dining in Cheviot, and worsted at dubious tilde table d apostrophe hotes tilde, at whirlwind lunch counters, on sandwiches and beer in his hall bedroom. He was willing to do that, for he was a true son of the great city of Razzle Dazzle, and to him one evening in the limelight made up for many dark ones. Chandler protracted his walk until the 40s began to intersect the great and glittering Primrose Way, for the evening was yet young, and when one is of the tilde bonde tilde only one day in 70, one loves to protract the pleasure. Eyes bright, sinister, curious, admiring, provocative, alluring were bent upon him, for his garb and air proclaimed him a devotee to the hour of solace and pleasure. At a certain corner he came to a standstill, proposing to himself the question of turning back toward the showy and fashionable restaurant in which he usually dined on the evenings of his especial luxury. Just then a girl scuttled lightly around the corner, slipped on a patch of icy snow, and fell plump upon the sidewalk. Chandler assisted her to her feet with instant and solicitous courtesy. The girl hobbled to the wall of the building, leaned against it, and thanked him demurely. "I think my ankle is strained," she said. "T-twisted when I fell." "Does it pain you much?" inquired Chandler. "Only when I rest my weight upon it. I think I will be able to walk in a minute or two." "If I can be of any further service," suggested the young man, "I will call a cab, or—" "Thank you," said the girl, softly but heartily. "I'm sure you need not trouble yourself any further. It was so awkward of me. And my shoe heels are horridly common sense. I can't blame them at all." Chandler looked at the girl, and found her swiftly drawing his interest. She was pretty in a refined way, and her eye was both merry and kind. She was inexpensively clothed in a plain black dress that suggested a sort of uniform such as shop girls wear. Her glossy dark brown hair showed its coils beneath a cheap hat of black straw whose only ornament was a velvet ribbon and bow. She could have posed as a model for the self-respecting working girl of the best type. A sudden idea came into the head of the young architect. He would ask this girl to dine with him. Here was the element that his splendid but solitary periodic feasts had lacked. His brief season of elegant luxury would be doubly enjoyable if he could add to it a lady's society. This girl was a lady, he was sure her manner and speech settled that. And in spite of her extremely plain attire he felt that he would be pleased to sit at table with her. These thoughts passed swiftly through his mind, and he decided to ask her. It was a breach of etiquette, of course, but oftentimes wage-earning girls waived formalities in matters of this kind. They were generally shrewd judges of men, and thought better of their own judgment than they did of useless conventions. His $10, discreetly expended, would enable the two to dine very well indeed. The dinner would no doubt be a wonderful experience thrown into the dull routine of the girl's life, and her lively appreciation of it would add to his own triumph and pleasure. "I think," he said to her, with frank gravity, "that your foot needs a longer rest than you suppose. Now, I am going to suggest a way in which you can give it that, and at the same time, do me a favor. I was on my way to dine all by my lonely self, when you came tumbling around the corner. You come with me, and we'll have a cozy dinner and a pleasant talk together, and by that time your game ankle will carry you home very nicely, I am sure." The girl looked quickly up into Chandler's clear, pleasant countenance. Her eyes twinkled once very brightly, and then she smiled ingenuously. "But we don't know each other, it wouldn't be right, would it?" she said, doubtfully. "There is nothing wrong about it," said the young man, candidly. "I'll introduce myself, permit me, Mr. Towers Chandler. After our dinner, which I will try to make as pleasant as possible, I will bid you good evening, or attend you safely to your door, whichever you prefer. But, dear me, said the girl, with a glance at Chandler's faultless attire. I in his old dress and hat. Never mind that, said Chandler, cheerfully. I'm sure you look more charming in them than anyone we shall see in the most elaborate dinner toilette. My ankle does hurt yet, admitted the girl, attempting a limping step. Think I will accept your invitation, Mr. Chandler. You may call me Miss Marion. Come then, Miss Marion, said the young architect, gaily, but with perfect courtesy. You will not have far to walk. There is a very respectable and good restaurant in the next block. You will have to lean on my arm so and walk slowly. It is lonely dining all by oneself. I'm just a little bit glad that you slipped on the ice. When the two were established at a well-appointed table, with a promising waiter hovering in attendance, Chandler began to experience the real joy that his regular outing always brought to him. The restaurant was not so showy or pretentious as the one further down Broadway, which he always preferred, but it was nearly so. The tables were well filled with prosperous-looking diners. There was a good orchestra, playing softly enough to make conversation a possible pleasure, and the cuisine and service were beyond criticism. His companion, even in her cheap hat and dress, held herself with an air that added distinction to the natural beauty of her face and figure. And it is certain that she looked at Chandler, with his animated, but self-possessed manner and his kindling and frank blue eyes, with something not far from admiration in her own charming face. Then it was that the madness of Manhattan, the frenzy of fuss and feathers, the bacillus of brag, the provincial plague of Poe seized upon Towers Chandler. He was on Broadway, surrounded by pomp and style, and there were eyes to look at him. On the stage of that comedy he had assumed to play the one-night part of a butterfly of fashion, and an idler of means and taste. He was dressed for the part, and all his good angels had not the power to prevent him from acting it. So he began to prate to Miss Marion of clubs, of teas, of golf and riding, and kennels and cotillions and tours abroad, and threw out hints of a yacht lying at Larchmont. He could see that she was vastly impressed by this vague talk, so he endorsed his pose by random insinuations concerning great wealth, and mentioned familiarly a few names that are handled reverently by the proletariat. It was Chandler's short little day, and he was wringing from it the best that could be had, as he saw it. And yet once or twice he saw the pure gold of this girl shine through the mist that his egotism had raised between him and all objects. This way of living that you speak of, she said, sounds so futile and purposeless. Haven't you any work to do in the world that might interest you more? My dear Miss Marion, he exclaimed, Ork. Think of dressing every day for dinner, of making half a dozen calls in an afternoon with a policeman at every corner ready to jump into your auto and take you to the station if you get up any greater speed than a donkey cart's gait. We do-nothings are the hardest workers in the land. The dinner was concluded, the waiter generously fed, and the two walked out to the corner where they had met. Miss Marion walked very well now. Her limp was scarcely noticeable. Thank you for a nice time, she said, frankly. Must run home now. I liked the dinner very much, Mr. Chandler. He shook hands with her, smiling cordially, and said something about a game of bridge at his club. He watched her for a moment, walking rather rapidly eastward, and then he found a cab to drive him slowly homeward. In his chilly bedroom, Chandler laid away his evening clothes for a 69-day rest. He went about it thoughtfully. That was a stunning girl, he said to himself. He's all right too, I'd be sworn, even if she does have to work. Perhaps if I'd told her the truth instead of all that razzle-dazzle we might, but, confound it, I had to play up to my clothes. Thus spoke the brave who was born and reared in the wigwams of the tribe of the Manhattans. The girl, after leaving her entertainer, sped swiftly across town until she arrived at a handsome and sedate mansion 2 squares to the east, facing on that avenue which is the highway of Mammon and the auxiliary gods. Here she entered hurriedly, and descended to a room, where a handsome young lady in an elaborate house dress was looking anxiously out the window. "Oh, you madcap!" exclaimed the elder girl, when the other entered. "When will you quit frightening us this way? It is 2 hours since you ran out in that rag of an old dress and Marie's hat. Mama has been so alarmed. She sent Louis in the auto to try to find you. You are a bad, thoughtless puss." The elder girl touched a button, and a maid came in a moment. "Marie, tell Mama that Miss Marion has returned." "Don't scold, sister. I only ran down to me. Theo's to tell her to use mauve insertion instead of pink. My costume and Marie's hat were just what I needed. Everyone thought I was a shop girl, I am sure. Dinner is over, dear. You stayed so late." "I know. I slipped on the sidewalk and turned my ankle. I could not walk, so I hobbled into a restaurant and sat there until I was better. That is why I was so long." The two girls sat in the window seat, looking out at the lights and the stream of hurrying vehicles in the avenue. The younger one cuddled down with her head in her sister's lap. "We will have to marry someday," she said dreamily, "both of us. We have so much money that we will not be allowed to disappoint the public. Do you want me to tell you the kind of a man I could love, sis?" "Go on, you scatterbrain," smiled the other. "I could love a man with dark and kind blue eyes, who is gentle and respectful to poor girls, who is handsome and good and does not try to flirt. But I could love him only if he had an ambition, an object, some work to do in the world. I would not care how poor he was if I could help him build his way up. But, sister dear, the kind of man we always meet, the man who lives an idle life between society and his clubs, I could not love a man like that, even if his eyes were blue, and he were ever so kind to poor girls whom he met in the street." By courier, it was neither the season nor the hour when the park had frequenters. And it is likely that the young lady, who was seated on one of the benches at the side of the walk, had merely obeyed a sudden impulse to sit for a while and enjoy a foretaste of coming spring. She rested there, pensive and still. A certain melancholy that touched her countenance must have been of recent birth, for it had not yet altered the fine and youthful contours of her cheek, nor subdued the arch, though resolute curve of her lips. A tall young man came striding through the park along the path near which she sat. Behind him tagged a boy carrying a suitcase. At sight of the young lady, the man's face changed to red, and back to pale again. He watched her countenance as he drew near, with hope and anxiety mingled on his own. He passed within a few yards of her, but he saw no evidence that she was aware of his presence or existence. Some 50 yards further on, he suddenly stopped and sat on a bench at one side. The boy dropped the suitcase and stared at him with wondering, shrewd eyes. The young man took out his handkerchief and wiped his brow. It was a good handkerchief, a good brow, and the young man was good to look at. He said to the boy, "I want you to take a message to that young lady on that bench. Tell her I am on my way to the station to leave for San Francisco, where I shall join that Alaska moose hunting expedition. Tell her that, since he has commanded me neither to speak nor to write to her, I take this means of making one last appeal to her sense of justice, for the sake of what has been. Tell her that to condemn and discard one who has not deserved such treatment, without giving him her reasons or a chance to explain, is contrary to her nature as I believe it to be. Tell her that I have thus, to a certain degree, disobeyed her injunctions, in the hope that she may yet be inclined to see justice done. Go, and tell her that." The young man dropped a $0.50 into the boy's hand. The boy looked at him for a moment with bright, canny eyes out of a dirty, intelligent face, and then set off at a run. He approached the lady on the bench a little doubtfully, but unembarrassed. He touched the brim of the old plaid bicycle cap perched on the back of his head. The lady looked at him coolly, without prejudice or favor. "Lady," he said, "that gent on the odor bench sent yer a song and dance by me. If yer don't know the guy, and he's trying to do the Johnny act, say the word, and I'll call a cop in 3 minutes. If yer does know him, and he's on the square, why I'll spiel yer the bunch of hot air he sent yer." The young lady betrayed a faint interest. "A song and dance," she said, in a deliberate sweet voice that seemed to clothe her words in a diaphanous garment of impalpable irony. "A new idea in the troubadour line, I suppose. I used to know the gentleman who sent you, so I think it will hardly be necessary to call the police. You may execute your song and dance, but do not sing too loudly. It is a little early, yet for open-air vaudeville, and we might attract attention." "Ah," said the boy, with a shrug down the length of him, "yer know what I mean, lady. 'Tain't a turn, it's wind. He told me to tell yer he's got his collars and cuffs in that grip for a scoot clean out to Frisco. Then he's going to shoot snowbirds in the Klondike. He says yer told him not to send round no more pink notes, nor come hanging over the garden gate, and he takes this means of putting yer wise. He says yer refereed him out like a has-been, and never give him no chance to kick at the decision. He says yer swiped him, and never said why." The slightly awakened interest in the young lady's eyes did not abate. Perhaps it was caused by either the originality or the audacity of the snowbird hunter in thus circumventing her express commands against the ordinary modes of communication. She fixed her eye on a statue standing disconsolate in the disheveled park, and spoke into the transmitter. "Tell the gentleman that I need not repeat to him a description of my ideals. He knows what they have been, and what they still are. So far as they touch on this case, absolute loyalty and truth are the ones paramount. Tell him that I have studied my own heart as well as one can, and I know its weakness as well as I do its needs. That is why I decline to hear his pleas, whatever they may be. I did not condemn him through hearsay or doubtful evidence, and that is why I made no charge. But, since he persists in hearing what he already..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.